Now, it's really where all the action is, as well as in the military. We train more drone pilots in the U.S. Air Force than we do fixed-wing pilots for our Air Force. We use that many drones. And the drone industries, of which there are now like 900 of them in the United States, want to get these things in commercial use because the military is just one part of it. There need to be drones everywhere, everywhere. And so the drone lobby, of which there is a congressional caucus, a drone caucus that our congressmen and women are in, have passed a law saying that by the year 2016, the FAA has to have completed the procedures for figuring out how 30,000 drones can be integrated into U.S. commercial airspace in 1 year. 30,000 drones that are going to be flying alongside of your commercial aircraft. 30,000 drones that, well, we don't know anything about the training of drone operators. We don't know the reliability of the types of drones. There's so much that's going to have to happen in this period, and the designated of six areas in the United States where the testing will come about, I would just like to say I hope I don't live in one of them. Thank you.
This is no time for celebration. This is no time for shaking hands. This is no time for backslapping. This is no time for marching bands. This is no time for optimism. This is no time for endless fun. This is no time for my country right or wrong. Remember what that brought. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. This is no time for congratulations. This is no time to turn your back. This is no time for circumlocution. This is no time for learned speech. This is no time to count your blessings. This is no time for private gain. This is a time to put up a shut up. It won't come back this way again. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. This is no time to swallow anger. This is no time to ignore hate. This is no time to be acting frivolous, because the time is getting late. This is no time for private vendettas. This is no time to not know who you are. Self-knowledge is a dangerous thing, the freedom of who you are. This is no time to ignore warnings. This is no time to clear the plate. Let's not be sorry after the fact and let the past become our fate. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time. This is no time to turn a wing drink or smoke some vials of crack. This is a time to gather force and take dead aim and attack. This is no time for celebration. This is no time for saluting flags. This is no time for inner searchings. The future is at hand. This is no time for phony rhetoric. This is no time for political speech. This is a time for action, because the future's within reach. This is the time. This is the time. This is the time, because there is no time. There is no time. There is no time. There is no time.
Thank you for listening to Earthwatch tonight here on the AI. Please send an email to your host, Robert Knight. That's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf coming up with Jim Freund.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And this is Ken Gale sitting in for Jim Freund, who is not feeling all that well right now, so he asked me to sub for him, and I was certainly pleased to do so. Are the Tearjerkers, which when I was doing Nuff Said regularly would open up every show, almost every show. They're a band out of Belfast in Ireland, and I used to interview writers and artists in the comic book field for 15 years or whatever, and Jim Freund is Hour of the Wolf is where Nuff Said started back in 1993. And so here I am again. And Jim always starts his show with a movie review. And by sheer coincidence, the movie review is for a comic book movie.
Ah.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. They could have called Thor the Dark World Thor Oakland because, frankly, there isn't much there. You've got your basic plot. Bad guy wants to get a hold of stuff that'll destroy the universe. Thor, played by Chris Hemsworth, and Loki, played by Tom Hiddleston, form an uneasy alliance to stop him. Plot complication, such as it is that the stuff, called ether, by the way, which just shows how hard everybody was working when the term they picked to describe the universe-destroying stuff is just a fancier way of saying stuff, but this stuff winds up literally in the hands of Natalie Portman's Jane Foster, so she becomes the beanbag that gets tossed around a bit. The special effects are nice, and the production design is as well. Tom Hiddleston is always fun to spend time with. They should be doing movies called Loki if they knew what was good for them. There are real deaths and fake deaths of important characters. There are a couple of plot twists that are not plot twists to anyone who knows his or her plot twists. Thor, The Dark World, bottom line, is not necessarily a bad movie, just an indifferent one. So let's not talk about it anymore. Let's talk instead about a curious little dark Spanish fantasy called Animals. It's kind of a twisted teen coming-of-age tale. The story focuses on Paul, spelled P-O-L, a teenager having some trouble as he teeters on the precipice of adulthood. He's got his own clutch of friends in high school. He's having some trouble concentrating on lessons. He's concerned about a classmate who has mysteriously disappeared, and he's feeling a particular attraction to another male student who may at the very least be self-destructive or may be out-and-out sociopathic. At the same time, childhood keeps pulling him back in the form of Deerhoof, an animated animatronic teddy bear that follows Paul around and talks to him in English with a deliberately synthesized-sounding voice. And there Paul stands, the comforts of youth beckoning from one side, the responsibilities and perils of maturity calling from the other. Clearly, drastic steps must be taken, but how drastic and towards which side remain to be seen. The packaging for Animal says that it's David Lynch meets Donnie Darko. That's a helpful description, but also not, in that Donnie Darko was essentially what Hollywood thought a Lynchian tale marketed towards teens would be like. So things are getting a little redundant there, which isn't out of place in a Lynchian context, but isn't really helping either. For another, director Marcel Ferez avoids the kind of glib pandering that suffused Donnie Darko. The empathy feels real here, as does the understanding of these kids and what they are going through as they confront a very threatening world and the hypocrisies and delusions of the grown-ups supposedly guiding them toward adulthood. For all the fantastical elements, there's very little hyperbole to the tale. It's quiet, restrained, and captures a tumultuous period of life both with deserved terror and with no little sympathy. So send the kids off to see Thor: The Dark World, hang out at home, and take in Animals yourself. You'll be happier that way. I'm Dan Persons. Please check out our Kickstarter by searching on the term Cinefantastique or by using the links over at cfqonline.com.
And now for the enough said portion of this show. It's got a bittersweet aspect to it because we'll be talking about one of the best artists that America has produced. And yet we're also talking about him because he passed away on November 3rd. And that's Nick Carty.
Carty!
And
my favorite artist.
And I brought to the air, Mercy Van Vlack. Long-time listeners of Nusted may remember her as the intrepid reporter.
All the news that fits
and,
on the air.
She's an artist as and a fan, and Nick Carty is a profound influence. And when
he draws
we were,
the best hair.
And we'll get to that in a little bit. And when we were talking about what music to play, it had to be this one.
Back to the right.
So, Mercy, why did you want me to play that song?
Señorita Rio was a character that Nick Carty drew for Fight Comics at Fiction House in 1940s until 1943, where he went off to war. And she was a spy, and she was outrageously, she was really strong.
He drew her before he went to war?
Yeah, he drew her for 3 years before he went off to the war. From 1940. He also did Jumbo Comics and Jungle Comics, Planet Comics, and Wings Comics. Wing Comics was about airplanes and stuff with intrepid ladies. Lots of pinup art. And that's where you really got to see a lot of his characters develop. And beautiful art. Incredible, beautiful stuff. It was just amazing. And I used to do drawings for somebody who worked at Washington Lee University who was really in your Señorita Rio because that was his childhood, you know, that he loved reading those when he was a kid. And I was channeling Nick Carty the whole time because he draws the best hair. And beautiful gals. His gals are amazingly gorgeous. And so Señorita Rio was the main character that I came into. And then when he went off to war, the strip was taken over by a gal. Lily Renee, who recently was at San Diego Con, one of the first cons she went to. And she could draw in the style of Nick Carty. She did the cover with the sword fight where she's fencing on the front cover in the rain, you know, with the dress. And this is a lady in high heels and a dress doing all the stuff James Bond does, you know, jumping off of buildings and getting captured and getting away. And
if you're a drawing, you can wear that stuff.
Yeah, if it's a drawing, yeah. Leading revolutions. And then he'd have ones where she's on the phone and playing with her shoes, you know, beautiful stuff. It's just amazing. And then he went to war, and then he survived, and he came back, and in 47 he picked up and started doing all the Fiction House stuff again that he had been doing before that. This was before he worked at DC. This was years before that.
Decades before.
Yeah, and you think decades. He started out in Eisner?
Yeah.
In Iger's studios?
He started working for Will Eisner, one of the greats in the entire history of comics.
He did Lady Luck, and he had an Italian character called Piccolo, and it was very, very silly. He always did very gorgeous gals and very goofy characters that would just show up in the story that would make you... I mean, his stuff was funny. It was obviously done with a lot of love, and it was very, very funny stuff. So even though it was serious and sexy and interesting, there was always this funny angle to his art, which I thought really brought people into it, too, that he did this funny stuff, too. Like Batlash. I'm jumping ahead, though. When he worked at Eisner and Iger, he was saying how he was amazed in the 30s in the comic shop
in
there.
39.
In 39. They worked for $18 a week. And it was the Depression. You know, they were really glad to get that kind of money. And he didn't really get a serious art education. He didn't go to art school because it was the Depression. There was no money for that. He spent a lot of time at the New York City art museums and at the Illustrators Society, where he spent a lot of time drawing.
And
just
the Art Students League, right?
No, it was the Illustrators Society. Okay. Yeah, the Illustrators Society. And he's sort of self-taught. And, you know, being in the Eisner-Iger studios, you learn a lot real quick, you know, because they need people to do this and that and the other thing to produce the amount of stuff they did.
Yeah, it's funny reading or rereading the Nick Carty book. And he mentioned just being acquainted with some of the great artists, you know, the fine artists that from the Renaissance, and going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and studying the art there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, kids can't do that anymore because now they charge you $25 to get in. Used to
it's
be you paid what you wish.
Yeah,
so
you could go anytime.
If you were a student, you know, you pay a quarter, a dollar, whatever, and go in.
Yeah, it's really rotten.
Now Bloomberg said, oh, no, art is for the rich. And so that's it. So people like Nick Carty, the youngsters coming up, they're not going to have that opportunity.
It's a rip.
And Nick Carty did, and his original name was Viscardi.
Nicholas Viscardi, yep.
V-I-S-C-A-R-D-I.
Yep. Yep.
And then he legally changed it to Cardy because of prejudice toward Italians.
Yep. Which is kind of funny because in Lady Luck he had that character Piccolo, who was Italian, which cracked me up because I knew he was Italian. So that was very funny. He's quite a character. He said he really enjoyed drawing the Teen Titans because it was a challenge to draw children because the Titans were in their preteen years. They were, you know, 14, 15, you know. They're very young teenagers. And he talks about that in this book, where there's a lot of interviews in this book, which I'll be quoting stuff from. And he said, you know, because they're not really, as an adult, things are in proportion, but kids' heads are bigger, and the way their body is proportioned is different than adults. So you don't want them to look like adults with big heads, which a lot of people have that problem. Yeah. When they draw kids, they look really strange because they just give them a big head, and the body is in the wrong kind of a proportion for a kid. But he took it as a challenge, and he did an incredible job. I mean, his kids looked like kids. He's never had trouble with that, whereas some illustrators can't handle that. It is difficult. It's not an easy thing.
It's amazing work, absolutely mm-hmm. amazing work. And I mean, he's best known for Aquaman and the Teen Titans.
Brave and Bold.
And Batlash in the 60s. And then he's very well known for doing most of the covers for DC Comics in the 70s.
Yeah, he did almost all the covers.
But I guess. He also did work for Marvel's Crazy Magazine, that silly streak that he got to show totally for Marvel, and National Lampoon, where he got to do the silly streak for a slightly older audience than Crazy had.
He did one with Batman being an aged person with a walker, fighting the Josher, you know, and his old bat fart, you know, it's hysterical. And Robert, the boy accountant, who was like popping out of his suit because he's chubby and drinking too much beer and sitting around doing accounting instead of running around. And then the old bat is what they call Batgirl, and she accidentally sets off the bat symbol. So the old bat fart comes running along with his walker, you know, to try and solve the crime. And it's very funny. And he just had this incredibly humorous streak. Well, Batlash really showed that. If you've ever seen Batlash, it's really beautifully done. He does these very atmospheric sort of pictures. He takes you into the story. That's what always impressed me with his art. You're in the picture. You're not standing outside watching somebody do stuff. You're in it. He put things in the foreground. Like when he did Jungle Books, he'd put, you know, branches and trees. So you go into the clearing with the people in the story. So you would go into the stories, which I always thought was amazing, because it's quite a thing to just tell a story, but it's another thing to bring you into the story.
The cinematic aspects of his art.
Yeah, yeah.
Because like so many comic book artists, he studied film. And it's interesting because comic book artists study film to do comics better, and filmmakers study comics to do film better.
Right.
And they go back and forth. And I think because if you're a student of those two art forms, you can look at it more objectively, looking at it through the eyes of another art form.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sort of study, well, if you're looking at film, why did the director pull the camera back just then? Or why did he raise the camera? What effect did the director get? And if you were drawing that story, would you get the same effect doing the same thing? Or would you get it doing something else? So you have to think the same way.
That's one of the amazing things about comics is your budget. For when you're going to make a film, you don't need a zoom camera. You don't need a what do they call those? They take it up on the
a crane
shot, because you can draw that. You can be underneath a car looking at somebody across the street without having to set that up. And you don't have to wait for the rain to stop. You know, that's the most amazing thing about comics is you can be anywhere and doing anything at any time. And all you need is your pen and your pencil and your imagination, maybe a good scrap file or a library with lots of good pictures, or these days, I guess, the internet.
You can play with time in a way that film can't.
You can slow things down in a comic book and make people linger over a panel.
And also, a single panel is actually a multitude of time, right? You have several bits of dialogue happening in the same panel. Well, they're not said simultaneously. It's one after another. And it could be a split second. It could be at the same time. It could be, you know, a minute. And then the body language of the character, as an artist, you would decide, do you want to draw the body language to fit what the person is saying, what the other person is saying, or something in between?
Right.
And as a reader, you just sort of read it. And you look at it, and you can tell from the context and everything else how long a period of time you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
But you can play with time when you draw it the way you can't do it when you're performing it. It's much more linear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like in a movie situation. Yeah. His comic books have a lot more ways of showing stuff like that. That, you know, you can slow things down, you know, get them to pause or speed it up and push, you know, next day. One time there was a She-Hulk comic where she walked to the next panel and had a different costume because she's a comic book character. She can do that. I like that aspect of John Byrne when he played with those kind of memes of she could travel and just go, okay, I'm across town now. I'm at Renee's office or something.
And he did Aquaman.
Yeah.
In the 60s.
Beautiful stuff.
Is my favorite of the Nick Carty work.
Mm. I always thought he made him look like Captain Kirk from the Enterprise. He had this sort of the tousled hair and the boyish good looks, you know.
So he was drawing Aquaman before Star Trek came out.
Oh, that's a problem. Yeah. Well, I always thought that. And his Mara was amazing. He says, I like to portray pleasant, sexy girls without being crude. You can look at a girl simply standing, and she can be sexy as hell.
Well, yeah, if you have Nick Carty's talent, she can be.
His gals are just outrageously gorgeous. They always had these wonderful lips. He did beautiful lips and the hair, the flowing locks that just rippled down, like Rio, like Senorita Rio. And I would see Senorita Rio and see Wonder Girl, you know, in the stuff that he did, because the dark-haired characters, you know. And his Wonder Woman was amazing, too. And he did Wonder Woman a couple times with Brave and Bold and other things. And his Black Canary was amazing in Brave and Bold when they did the team-up with Batman. It was funny because I never quite liked his Batman of all the characters. He always looked worried. He didn't put the black on his forehead. He sort of had this brow-looking thing. He had his brow showing through his mask. So his Batman always looked a little strange. But his gals were amazing. And his Robin was somebody I fell in love with a long time ago. I used to watch the Batman TV show when it first came out, and it was embarrassing. Because before that, I had read a couple comics. You know, we'd be on our way to the beach, and Dad would say, all right, here's $10, go and buy everything on the rack, which you could back in the 60s. You could buy everything, get the Archies and the little hot stuff and Harvey comics and all the DC and Marvel. And we'd sit in the back seat and read them. And I kept the 25-cent Giants, the 80-page Giants, because it was Batman and Robin. I really thought Robin was kind of neat. It was interesting. I didn't understand why Bob Kane's art style changed so much from story to story, because it said Bob Kane, but I don't think he drew them.
He didn't do any of them.
No. And then the TV show came out, and I was so embarrassed, I stopped reading comics for a while. And then I was doing something. I went to a 7-Eleven or something, and there was this Teen Titans comic. And I looked at it, and I was like, wow, Robin's really cute. And look at Kid Flash and Wonder Girl. And I was just amazed. And Aqualad was amazing. So I started reading comics again. And from there, I got into Brave and Bold. And I just got back into comics. So Nick Carty brought me back when I strayed.
Wow.
Yeah. It's his fault. Or his credit.
Or his credit.
I was just amazed by his drawings. I just loved his character. His Teen Titans were just great.
And it was interesting is when people talk about Nick Carty, they'll go, you know, Aquaman, Teen Titans, and Batlash. Now, Batlash only lasted 6 issues.
Oh, it's so
good. And there
good.
Was one issue of Showcase.
Yeah.
But it made
so
such
fun.
A huge splash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Will he save the West or ruin it?
Yeah, those of you very much into comics are probably going, yeah, Batlash.
Ooh.
But those of you who are not, if you know the TV show Maverick with James Garner that came out in the early 60s, Batlash definitely owes a lot to that, where mm-hmm. there's this a lot of humor at the same time as the action. And there's a couple other Westerns.
Paladin.
Yeah,
There was a Paladin on YouTube we were watching the other day. It's got Colonel Klink in it, the guy who played Colonel Klink. So they
Warren
say,
Kemper,
oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, Warren and Kemper. And they say, Colonel Klink meets Batlash, because it's so much like a Batlash story. He's into the food. He's talking about cuisine, because the guy who plays Paladin was a gourmet. Also, when he's in San Francisco, he always dresses
like
beautifully.
Batlash, right.
And he's a gourmet. He talks about the wine sauce. He loves a good meal. So here's this guy who's a French chef. And things keep happening that are hilarious with the local yokels who are like drunk and crazy, because it's a mining town in the middle of the West someplace. And it's just hilarious to watch. And it just made me think so much of, like, Nick Carty must have drawn this, because it's just like Batlash.
Yeah, and of course it came first.
Yeah, right.
But,
so it couldn't have been.
But yeah,
again,
Westerns were so popular in the 50s and 60s that there were lots and lots of different ways of doing Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, comedy, whether overstated or understated, is one of the ways that Westerns were done. Not all of them, but some of them. Maverick and sometimes Have Gun Will Travel was like,
right,
but not,
Paladin,
but not always.
Have Gun Will Travel.
Have Gun Will Travel had a lot of different types of stories. And in fact, a lot of the Star Trek writers wrote for Have Gun Will Travel.
Right.
Including Gene Roddenberry himself.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote
some
over,
of them were political.
And yeah, Gene Roddenberry especially.
Serious political ones, yeah.
and
the way they portrayed the American Indians was always really that, like, these stupid people, you know, they did not make them look dumb. They made the white
American
people
Indians
look stupid.
we're talking 1958
cool.
to 1964.
They weren't monsters and savages. They were people, you know, who lived there.
We watched, by getting DVDs at the library, all of the first 4 seasons of Had Gun Will Travel, and Native Americans were never, ever the villains unless some idiot white guy started it.
Yeah.
And to see that being written in 1958 like that.
Yeah. Because you're also watching some Lone Rangers, like the first Lone Ranger. And Tonto goes into town to find out some stuff. And they go, get out of here, Indian. We don't want. And they're just being obnoxious. And I said, well, that's what people did back then. But it was hard to watch. It was really awful. It's like, why are you treating him like that? He's a nice guy. That's Jay Silverheel, you ding dong.
It is amazing that you think that of how backwards people were back then. Well, they weren't as backwards as I think.
Not everybody.
We think.
Yeah. Because Paladin certainly didn't treat them. He learned the language. He could converse with people.
And the way there was a story about a judge named Robert April. In one of the Have Guns Will Travel. Star Trek fans know that name.
Oh.
Big Star Trek fans know that name. And a very, very political story.
Mm-hmm.
Some very, abuse of power and independence of women and a lot of stuff was going on. So to think of Batlash as a comedy western and, oh, it must have been pretty dumb. Well, it wasn't. It was very well written. Sergi Aragonés was co-creator of it, along with, and Denny O'Neill wrote a lot of the issues. Top talent on that book, and of course, Nick Carty's artwork.
Yeah, and Mike Sikowski penciled one issue because there was a time crunch. And it turns out Mike Sikowski and Nick Carty went way back. And he said so many nice things about Sikowski. He's a very talented designer, and he just really respected him. They knew each other for years. And at one point, they did a comic book for a little small-sized publication
digest-sized
called Pillow Talk, which he's never mentioned in any publication. And I have copies of this because I couldn't believe it. I was at the Passaic Book Center, and I'm flipping through adult magazines because I like that kind of stuff. I like to draw ladies, and that's the best reference you can find. Naked ladies all over the place and naked guys, all this good stuff. So I'm flipping through Pillow Talk, and there's Nick Carty artwork. And it was called, I forgot what it's called now, The Strip. She would...
She was a sex therapist or something like that.
Yeah, people would call her up, and she would talk to them about... You know, like a gal, her husband went away to the Navy. And so what is she going to do? So she teaches her about vibrators, you know. And I couldn't believe I found this. And there were quite a few of my. I only have a few because it's what you could find. And I've never seen them reprinted anywhere.
Yeah,
and
people tend not to collect.
He wouldn't talk about it. He just was like embarrassed about it. And it was so cute. I mean, there's Lilith and Dick doing fun things. But, you know, there wasn't that much.
Yeah,
right, sorry, Dick Grayson, and a gal who looked just like Lilith, you know, in bed, rolling around, and it was just so much fun. And Sikowski worked on a couple of those, and sometimes...
Now, Mike Sikowski drew the Justice League,
right?
For those of you who know characters and not artists.
So I think they may have had a studio together, or they just knew each other for so long that when this job came up, they took turns working on it. Like, some of them were just Sikowski, some of them Carty inked, and other ones... They would take panels out that they wanted him to redo because of whatever. So there's two versions of some of the stories. And it's just such a great little strip. It was really cute. But he never talks about it. He's embarrassed by it. It's so funny. He's so nice. He doesn't want to be mean to anybody. He doesn't want anybody to get upset.
So those of you listening to WBAI right now, Hour of the Wolf, are learning things about Nick Carty that almost no one else in fandom knows. And this you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Ken Gale.
And this is Mercy Van Vleck.
And we're subbing for Jim Freund, who is a little under the weather. He'll be back next week doing a special on the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. Doctor Who began on November 23rd.
Wow.
1963, the day after John F. Kennedy was assassinated, Doctor Who began. And so there'll be commemorations all over the world.
Wow.
And one of those commemorations will be right here on WBAI in 1 week's time.
Yeah, check it out.
And
it should be fun. In fact, I think he's interviewing one of the people
who actually worked on it. Well, he's got some special celebrity guests.
That's exciting.
And,
yeah, we'll see who shows up.
and the show is still in formation, so he's still juggling.
That's exciting.
Oh, it's how many people and how long each person is on.
If you're a Time Lord, be sure to check in. All you Whovians out there.
Well, if you're a Time Lord, you've already checked in.
That's true. Yeah. And you were at Woodstock. That's why Woodstock was so crowded. There were so many time travelers there.
Yeah. So we're talking
about... Oh, her name was Orgasma in Pillow Talk. Orgasma. Yeah.
And we're talking about the artist Nick Carty,
Gertie.
He passed away on November 3rd. He was 93 years old.
Oh, that's a good run.
So, yeah, he had a very good run, 93.
That's pretty good.
And going to conventions. And
the first con he went to was Heroes Con.
Yeah, in North Carolina.
He never
Charlotte,
went
North
to
Carolina.
Conventions. I used to go to a lot of conventions. We went to San Diego, when we went to Motor City Con, and he was never there. But, you know, there were other people to hang out with, which was a lot of fun. But finally, he went to Heroes Con.
He didn't live that far away.
Yeah. He was living in Florida then. Yeah.
And I tried to get him for Enough Said. I was still doing Enough Said back then. And he was nervous to come on. He thought he would say something that would embarrass himself or someone else.
He was so worried that he might say something.
I don't do that kind of show.
He thought it was, you know, rant radio.
He thinks of radio
as
something
that
is done to embarrass people. That's not what I did. I wish Julie Schwartz had been there so he could have basically
told
Nick, go on her show. It's good. Julie wasn't there at the time.
That's a sad one that we missed, getting Nick Carty on the
air. Yeah.
Because he was amazing. He's so nice.
I was trying to get him on for your birthday, as a matter of fact.
That would have been good.
I was trying to arrange to have Nick Carty on WBAI on your birthday and sort of surprise you. Basically, when I sent the publicity out, I was going to say, oh, by the way, would you proofread this?
I would have been on the floor.
But it never got to happen.
That's cool. That's a nice idea.
But you did get to meet Nick.
And you did get
to give him some of your artwork.
I couldn't talk to him at first. Ken had to, like, drag me over there. I was like, it's Nick Carty. It's Nick Carty. Nick Carty. I was all freaking out. And Ken's like, you have to go say hello. And I'm like, oh, no. I was terrified because he's like a god. You know, you can't talk to him. And he's like my favorite artist. So Ken finally got me to go over there. And I was totally embarrassed. But then I got, like, this is so much fun. He was so nice. And he was so... I got to look at all his, he had a lot of original art with him. He was doing sketches and things. So I got to see that, which was really fun. And then I said, you know, you've really inspired me. And my art is all, you know, a lot of what I've learned from you. And I gave him a copy of Miranda the Tease. But this was the version
this
from
wasn't
Puritan
Miranda the Tease.
Magazine.
She was no longer a tease.
Yeah. She was my version of Señorita Rio. She's Hispanic. She's Puerto Rican. And she'll say things in Spanish. And some of her costumes were Señorita Rio designs, you know, because I figured it was carrying on the tradition of a spy, an espionage person who's a sort of a secret agent. And also this one, we don't draw back at the naughty parts. We dive in, you know, because it was Puritan magazine, which is anything but. It's the one they don't even put on the counter. You have to ask for it because it's got so many pictures in it that are so
rude.
It's
called Puritan, but it's not X-rated. It's triple X-rated.
Yeah, it's all the way.
And, of course, the internet has replaced a lot of those magazines.
Right,
I guess Puritan. I don't know if Puritan is still being published on paper or not.
I don't know.
But Mercy did Miranda the Tease for Leg Show magazine. And then
Miranda the Not-So-Teasing.
Yeah, the Not-So-Teasing for Puritan. And I wrote those stories because the editor wanted more actual plots.
Stories instead of la, 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 she falls, goes down the street and her clothes fall off. Yay! Basically.
And so it was the triple X-rated version that Mercy gave in full color because not only penciled it and inked it, but also painted it.
Yeah, it was colors, watercolors.
So it's watercolor.
Which and, Nick Carty likes watercolors.
Yeah.
And he sort of flips over, looks in, and puts it aside, like, well, thank you very much. And then he got real quiet, and I was like, uh-oh.
And then I was over at Dick Giordano had a table. We had a table in one part, and then Dick Giordano was sort of diagonally across an aisle from us, and Nick was in another section of the convention. And... So I was talking to Dick Giordano about coming on to Enough Said, which he eventually did.
Yay.
And his daughter was at the table.
She's got Wonder Woman hair. She's got mountains of whipped cream, chocolatey, beautiful dark hair. She's got great hair.
And it's like, you know, a lot of the guys at the convention are looking at Dick Giordano's daughter and talking about how gorgeous she is. And Mercy is talking about how much fun it would be to draw her.
Yeah. Oh, with a brush to ink that hair. Oh.
So Dick's daughter started talking about Mercy's artwork, and so Nick Carty says, I said, yeah, she showed it to me and how much I inspired her, and she has such a sweet face, and I looked at her artwork, I was shocked. And so I go over and
I look so innocent.
tell Mercy that, and I don't know if Mercy's feet actually hit the floor for the rest of the weekend.
Not. It was very. I was like, oh,
Nick Carty
I
said
have, a
you
sweet
have a sweet face.
He liked my art. Oh, he's shocked, but he liked it.
And he recognized that you draw hair the way he draws hair.
Well, he said a lot of people come up to him and say they were inspired by him. but he tells this story to people about what the artwork I gave him. He tells it to people all the time. His niece was telling you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, because at the next year's Heroes Convention, his niece said, by the way, Uncle Nick talks about Mercy all the time, but not by name. And then tells a story about that artwork.
She has such a sweet face. And then she hands me this rude stuff. I thought since he did Pillow Talk, it wouldn't be such a... But Pillow Talk was very tame compared to stuff
Pillow
I was turning up.
Kind of R-rated.
It's cute. Yeah.
Was it R-rated or was it X-rated?
I don't... There was naked tops, but no bottoms.
Yeah,
there was
it was really R-rated.
No members of the male, so that's what makes it R-rated, I guess, when you say penises.
But
so,
for the rest of the day, as Nick walked around the convention, there he has Miranda...
He's carrying around showing it to people because he was like... Can't believe she gave me this. I was like, well, you're Nick Carty. You have to see it.
I guess he didn't expect that from a female fan.
He didn't want to leave it around where someone would find it and think he did it or something. Oh, yeah, from a female fan.
Yeah, and
never
I remember
heard
one
of
point,
Olivia.
You were drawing Miranda, and at one point you were saying, oh, the hair's not coming out right. And you were complaining that it just wasn't right.
Yeah.
And then you said that, oh, I'm going to have to study Nick Carty comics. And said it like it was a bad thing.
It's work.
And I'm like, what? And so you tell me this, and I'm like, oh, poor Mercy. She has to look at the art of her favorite artist.
Think about what you're saying next time. Yeah. Right. Oh, you're right.
And she looked at me like, oh, yeah, right. What was I saying?
This is romping. This is great fun. I get to look at Nick Carty. Of course, I get lost, and I spend hours, but it's great fun. He also did the Tarzan comic strips that were in the paper.
Yeah, newspapers in the 50s.
Yeah, in the 50s. He did Tarzan. He did Congo Bill, which was
another Jungle Book. Complaining about Congo Bill because the writer knew nothing about animals or the jungle.
Yeah.
And he had done all this careful research when he was drawing Tarzan. And he was working with Bern Hogarth also, who was another giant in comics. And then the person who did Congo Bill had, you know, rhinoceroses charging zebras. Yeah, which...
India.
They never do.
Yeah, that doesn't work. Oops.
They just weren't paying attention to things, and they really bothered him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because it's comics doesn't mean it has
doesn't
to be
have to
wrong.
Be dumb. Yeah.
I certainly agree with that sentiment. And then in the late 60s, early 70s, Carmen Infantino, his good friend, got kicked upstairs and started having Nick do all the covers.
Mm-hmm. There was a time when every DC comic I had to buy them because they all had Nick Carty covers. It's like, that's got to be, got to get that one.
And
they're
really fun.
They're little stories, like the cover will be Superman flying by, but it's like a flat, you know, like a walk up in New York City, and there's little kids scruffing around, you know, sort of very Eisner-ish, I guess. And then the lady leaning out the window with her curlers on, you know, looking at the kids. And it's just a whole little story on that one cover. You know, he just did amazing layouts and design.
Which is what covers ought to be.
That's true. They should have a lot of stories.
You know, summarize the story in one panel.
Yeah.
And get people to get
to
into
go,
it.
Ooh, I want this.
And I remember as a young fan looking at those covers and thinking, wow, some of these are great and some of these are awful. And, you know, realize later that, well, you know, deadlines affect the quality of the art. And the tighter the deadline, the less the art.
Right.
And that's
going to
happen.
So much time.
You know, for any artist, whether you're a singer or drawing comic books or doing movies or doing radio shows, whatever, the more time you have to prepare, the better the results are going to be.
Yeah. You need more time sometimes.
And so Nick Carty did a lot of material, and everyone talked about what a nice guy he was.
What's the one, Daniel Boone? He did Daniel Boone
for Daniel
a while
Boone,
there.
Yeah.
Did
he did Tomahawk.
Tomahawk,
50s
yeah.
and 60s.
Yeah. Buckskin.
Which took place during the American Revolution. He was a history buff, and that's his favorite time of history. And I never got a chance to talk American history with him.
Oh, yeah. He's a big history fan.
Because, yeah, I only see him at conventions when there's a zillion things going on.
He said in one of the interviews, he said that there's an old saying that a painting needs to direct the viewer as if he were a visitor. Take him in the front door, show him around the room, and gradually leading the viewer out the back door. A painting has to compel the viewer to see things the way the painter intends it to be viewed. There has to be an entrance and an exit for the eye. But with comics, you also have to deal with captions and word balloons, for instance. But he studied painting. He did a lot of oil paintings. And during the war, There's a book out about his stuff during the war, which is hard to look at because it's war, but some of them look like photographs. They're beautiful paintings in watercolor. When he was really doing some amazing stuff, he'd just come from Fiction House where he was doing comics, and he loved doing watercolor. So here he was doing these beautiful wash drawings. I don't know. He had a little field paint kit, which was like a tin, like an Altoids. A Sucretz box. It was a metal box. And he had these paints in there and a brush that he cut off so it would fit in there. And he would use spit because where else are you going to get water? You know, yep. You can't use your canteen. He would do spit paintings with this little color box.
Yeah, so he would put the ink on the paper and then he would smear the ink with his finger and with spit to get a gray tone right? And get a wash. And
so that's pretty fascinating right there. You got to paint. You know, he just had to put this stuff down on paper. And there's beautiful pictures in that book.
And there's the pictures of ruins of a building. There's of a
refugees,
whole bunch of you know,
yeah.
And the
people
other
people in the rubble.
He drove a
soldiers.
Tank. He drove a Sherman tank.
He drove a tank
during
wow.
World War II in Europe. And
he got two purple
hearts. Reading his exploits, it is amazing that he survived World War II.
Right?
There are so many times at which something should have happened. And for example, he was in, I think, the 66th Division or something. He got sick on the way to Europe. He got sick. So when he gets to England, they put him in the hospital, and the rest of his unit goes to France by boat, and a German submarine sinks the boat.
Wow, that was close.
And hundreds of people die. The survivors are sworn to secrecy.
Oh.
Because they did not want the Germans to find out that they were sinking our boats successfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they didn't want to ruin the morale of the people who were fighting. So they were sworn to secrecy. And it was years before it was declassified and people could talk about it.
Wow.
But the likelihood, since most of the people on that boat died, a handful survived.
Holy Titanic.
The odds are that he would not have survived, but he was in the hospital.
Yeah.
And then he got two purple hearts.
Right.
And he's in a tank. Now, German tanks are more powerful than Sherman tanks. They could actually shoot through the armor of a Sherman
Yikes.
Tank. And he's in one. And there's several Sherman tanks and facing down in 88, he called it. And they get one. They get another one. He turns tail and goes, and he tries to go down a ditch. And what he said is you go down to the bottom of the ditch, and then you swing it to second gear so you can go up the other side of the ditch. And it didn't work.
How
the gear didn't
tank.
Work.
Oh.
So now he's stuck at the bottom of a ditch.
Ooh.
And here comes the tank.
Yike.
And the tank shoots him and misses.
Oh, it's like a movie. The bad guys always miss.
And he finally gets the tank going, and he's zooming down the ditch, hoping that they miss him again, and he never hears them. And he assumes another tank must have got that
one. Wow, it picked it off.
And he somehow survived it. Another point, he was away from the rest of the unit. He was totally cut off, and he got surrounded, and he survived that, but he didn't say how.
He does that a lot. He'll tell something, and then he just stops. It's like, wait, what? That's why I was so like the idea of getting him on Nuff Said was like, maybe we can ask him some of these questions. But he was didn't want to.
Yeah,
it'll
be
like,
don't stop there.
Wait,
tell the rest
more,
of the story.
Yeah.
But
yeah, he never had a nasty thing to say. He was always very kind to all his coworkers.
And that's why he wouldn't
editors.
Come on Nuff Said. He was afraid he might say something nasty because that's what radio does.
But
I'm like, no.
He would never say anything nasty. Everybody talks
so those
about
those morning
how
shock
nice
jocks.
He was.
I don't know if I could ever be a fan of a single solitary one of those shock jocks
that's
because
rude, what they did. To
I lost Nick Carty as a guest.
Because of those Dean Dons. Ah. Yeah, that's a shame.
That's a terrible shame.
In 1977, he worked on one of the early Star Wars posters.
Oh, yeah.
I had never seen this before, but it's in this book. It was Tom Jung did a picture of Leia and Luke, and he put in R2-D2 and C-3PO in the background.
Nick did.
Nick Carty did. And he touched it up a little bit. He fixed Luke's boots and made Leia a little slimmer, you know, for the poster, which I'm sure she appreciated, the actors. And so he actually worked on the Star Wars briefly. He did stuff for Crazy Magazine. That, like, Serpico, his caricatures were beautiful. They were amazing. Like, the characters just leaped out at you. And Jack Davis's caricatures were often kind of nasty. And he talks about that. He's like, well, I never did nasty. I was really nice to them. It's like, well, yeah, you're Nick Carty. That's what you do. He's nice.
Jack Davis did a lot of the caricatures for Mad Magazine. When you're bandying about names like this, Mercy, you have to let people know who they are.
Yeah. Jack Davis then went on. He was doing like advertising for a while, and he did the B. There was a B that was an ad, and he was doing covers of TV Guide like crazy.
Well, the only reason Jack Davis drew for Mad is because he liked going on the trips.
Oh, the vacations. Yeah, they had crazy vacations.
Bill Gaines would take the entire – he was the publisher, and he took the entire staff of Mad on vacations in some part of the world. And you had
to
do
Spain,
a minimum
France.
Number of pages for Mad in order to be included on the trip. So Jack would always do, because he would get thousands of dollars for a movie poster.
Right.
And he didn't get thousands of dollars to draw for Mad, but he did in order to go on the trip because he enjoyed
Nick Carty did a bunch of movie poster stuff.
And you're telling me that he did TV Guide covers.
I think so, because there's a bunch of drawings in this book. They say, you know, copyright their respective publishers, and they don't say what. So, like, he did, like, posters for Nickelodeon. He did the taking of Pelham 123. There was a newspaper ad. He did that as a as black and white drawing. He did a poster for Apocalypse Now. It was a submission that the agency felt the caricature of Marlon Brando was too humorous. There's Carty again. But this did appear in the Blue Book, which is a trade annual, which is like, you can hire this artist. And I happened to have that because I was working in advertising. And I went, Nick Carty! Ah! Carty, 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 Carty! And I grabbed that and ran with it. He also did a poster for California Suite with Alan Alda and a lot of other characters in it. But that was not used, because that's the whole thing about movie posters. You do them and they don't always use them. He did a poster for Meatballs 2 in watercolors and something for Those Lips, Those Eyes. So he did a lot of movie posters at one point in like 78. Movie, he did drawings for that.
Yeah, he moved away from comics
Cereal.
In the late 70s.
Yeah, he did more advertising
stuff.
He
didn't like the way the corporatization, basically. You know, when DC was a family-owned business, it was a lot more fun to work for than when it became really corporatized. And when it became Time Warner and AOL and whatever.
So he went into more advertising work, posters. Yeah. He also did a series of covers for romance books, little paperbacks, which I've seen a few of those. But he doesn't talk about that either, but they were like for romance publishers, because he used to do romance comics in the 60s. You'll find a lot of like DC girls romance type of ones. And I'm always at the Comic-Con looking through them, trying to find the Carty ones, you know, because there'll be a story in there that's like 5 pages long. Carty, Carty, Carty. So I'll grab that, you know, just very exciting to find something like that, because they didn't always put credit on them. You know, it was early comics. They didn't always put the credits on it. And they certainly didn't tell you on the cover, in this issue, Nick Carty, go bananas. You know, they didn't tell you. So you had to look through them to find those, you know. And here they actually have a list of a lot of his comics. So you can find them more easily. But they haven't reprinted those. You know, you don't see those.
Nah.
And like, where's Batlash as a graphic novel? Silly DC.
It might have been.
I haven't seen it. Maybe. They tried to bring Batlash back at one time, but with somebody else drawing it, it was flat. It was totally flat. It was just didn't work at all.
And there's a
and
subtlety
Sergio wasn't
to
writing
Batlash.
It. Sergio was writing it, too, which is hilarious.
That action and humor combination, that it has to really be the right... The right combination, otherwise it'll come out as dumb or just
lame. Yeah, just doesn't work. Yeah, it can be they're trying to be funny and they're just not funny. So do you want to take some
let's take some calls.
Open the lines. What's your favorite Nick Carty story?
Now I understand we've got our old number back. So it's 212-209-2900.
Oh yeah. Wow, 2900.
Yeah, it's
209-2900.
First time I've given that number on the air in a long time.
Call us if you're awake, if you're asleep.
209-2900.
Want to talk about comics or Nick Carty? Carty, Carty, Carty.
Talk about...
Especially Nick Carty.
Yeah, talk about comics, talk about art, but especially talk about Nick Carty's art.
Nicholas Viscardi.
He passed away on November 3rd, and I have still never, ever met a bigger Nick Carty fan than Mercy Van Black, who has joined me here in Hour of the Wolf. We're going until 3, and Jim Freund has let me sit in on the show. So 212-209-2900, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
How you doing?
We're good. What's up?
Well, you know, I was going to talk to Ken because I was on his show once. 7 years ago, and I'm really interested about Nick Carty. I didn't know he passed away.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, he had an obit in a couple of places, but he just didn't make the same splash that some of, like, Gene Colan or Gil
Dave
Kane
Cockrum.
Made when he passed away. And He was certainly an awfully important artist in this field. So you were on 7 years ago.
And we still got him?
You still there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Yes, sir. So who are you?
Tim from...
Oh, my goodness. You were on... This is Tim who did stuff on the street?
Hello, Tim. You still there?
Nope, we lost him.
Oh.
All right, well, call...
He used to sell comics on the
back.
Street. He's helped spreading the culture.
Yeah, that means I was...
Tim from the Bronx?
No, that's... I'm not sure what borough
Manhattan.
He's from, but...
But we saw him in Manhattan a couple times.
He was a guest on Nuff Said back in 2002.
Yeah, talking about what people read in comics.
And we just lost the other calls. If the phone rings and rings and rings, eventually Verizon will simply cut off the line.
Do.
And so you'll have to call back. And this will happen no matter who you call, whether it's BAI or your mom. 212-209-2900. And
Tim, that's neat to hear from him.
Yeah.
He's still out there then. That's good.
Tim was quite an inspiration for a lot of people
himself.
Well,
let's see if that's him again. Somebody's calling in.
212-209-2900. You're on the air.
Hello, Ken Gale.
Hi.
This is Robert from Manhattan. You and I have talked before about comics. Hello, Mercy.
Hello, Robert.
I want to ask you a few questions. You mentioned Batlash.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Is this the same Batlash who showed up on a wonderful episode, a dual episode, two-part episode of Justice League, when Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, and Batman had to chase a thief? They stole Batman's utility belt, and first they went to the Old West, and they met Batlash, and they met Alicia Smith, they met Jonah Hex.
I think so.
Yeah.
Is
this a comic book?
No, this was
the TV show.
This is animated.
Justice League. This is the animated Justice
League. Yeah.
Now tell me who Batlash exactly was.
He was a Western character. He had like a vest on with flowers on. He always had a flower in his hat.
Did he have superpowers?
No. But he was Batlash, like the Whiplash.
He was fast with a gun. But he hated to use it.
Yeah, he was nonviolent in his own way.
His real name was Bartholomew Aloysius something.
Batten Lash.
Yes.
No, Batten Lash is the artist.
Oh, never mind. Start again. It's very possible. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember he had a long name.
Yeah.
That's why he called himself Batlash, because it was too obscure.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he seemed to be familiar with ray guns, because it seems that some of these Western heroes seems to have traveled into the future.
That's interesting.
There was an episode in which we actually met Jonah Hex, and he was actually chasing Ra's al Ghul's son, Arkady Duval, who was attempting to take over the Old West in a sort of a flying aircraft carrier.
Well, the animators have their own continuity.
They go on their own trips, yeah.
And it's funny, because I haven't seen many episodes of the Justice League.
Oh, I love that. Yeah,
but I have seen, I did see one with Jonah Hex.
Yeah, well, Jonah Hex was actually he was a bounty hunter, I gather.
Yeah, he was a bounty hunter.
And he was chasing Ra's al Ghul. Apparently, had a lot of children, and because remember, he was very long lived.
He was immortal. Yeah,
yes, he was practically immortal. I mean, he was at least 600 years old that we know of.
Yeah.
But Ken, I want to ask you about westerns, if you don't mind, because I was watching tonight. So one of my favorite channels is Encore Westerns, and boy, you want to talk about the classic days. I'm watching here of. Episodes of Wyatt Earp from the 50s with Hugh O'Brien. And I'm telling you, now let me, and you.
I've never seen an episode of
Wyatt Earp.
Wyatt Earp,
brave, courageous, and bold.
Long
live his glory, and long may his story be told. And it's still being told. You saw it recently.
You know, it's funny because they just ran tonight on Turner Classics the wonderful, which I think is the best version of the gunfight at OK Corral with Frankie Lane singing the theme song. And Burt Lancaster.
Oh.
And Kirk Douglas as Doc Holliday.
Wow.
And it really is the best version. It totally screws part by Gaelic history. It was really. Now, here's some trivia.
I know DeForest Kelly was in one of the
yes,
versions.
Yes, he was. He was in the one tonight.
With his Virginian accent.
Yes, yes.
And his drawl.
You mentioned jungle comics.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1950s, there's a little bit of trivia for you guys. In the 1950s, there were a lot of jungle programs on television. It was Tarzan.
Right.
There was Jungle Jim with Johnny Weissmuller.
Which was based on a comic strip.
Right. There was Ramar of the Jungle. He was a doctor. and he went to Africa and India to save the natives, you know. And then there was a program for 2 years called Sheena, Queen of the Jungle,
right?
Irish McCullough. Now, wait a second. Do you know why they gave her the name Sheena? I'll tell you.
Because Shanna was the comic.
No, Sheena.
No, Sheena was created by Jerry Iger.
Yeah, but Sheena is the Irish name for Jane.
Oh, my. That's funny.
And I found this out because I found this out because I was at a music camp in Canada, and I met a woman whose name was Sheena, and she said, yes, I remember this series, and it turns out that they gave her that name because they wanted a TV character to be sort of a Jane, an active feminine, you know, big Jane figure, so they took the name Sheena, which is Irish for Jane. Now, I want to ask you about some of Nick Carty's work. You mentioned Teen Titans. This is not the current Teen Titans you're talking about.
Right. This is from
the 60s.
This
is not the Beast Boy, Raven, Starfire.
No.
Now, this is Dick Grayson, Robin, Kid Flash, Aqualad, Speedy, and Wonder Girl.
Now,
there was only one gal in the team.
Yeah,
Corey hadn't shown up yet.
Yeah,
Perez.
No, this Teen Titan bunch I saw in the old sort of 1960s, sort of cheesy animated Teen Titans, Superman, Green Lantern,
they were the kid sidekicks of the superheroes.
Were these Teen Titans precursors to Green Arrow? I mean, were these sort of the junior members before they became full superheroes?
No, they were other characters who were teammates of Green Arrow and Batman. Batman and Robin.
Happened when Robin came out in 1940? He became really, really popular. So editors gave lots and lots of characters sidekicks.
Ah.
And some of the sidekicks were adults. Some of the sidekicks were kids.
Because Wally West was Flash's sidekick.
Yes.
And okay.
Sidekick kind of implies that they did a lot of stories together. Kid Flash and Flash did some stories together, but Kid Flash had a lot of solo stories. They didn't live in the same town.
Now, what about Aqualad? Was he sort of a sidekick to Aquaman?
Yes, he was a sidekick to Aqualad.
Now, was there a Wonder Girl?
That's a very complicated story. Originally, there were comics where we had Wonder Tot, The Adventures of Wonder Woman as a Tot, and Wonder Girl, The Adventures of Wonder Woman when she was a teenager, and then we had Wonder Woman.
Because
and
didn't she come out literally during World War II from Paradise Island to save the world from the fascists?
Wonder Woman, yeah.
Yeah, Wonder Woman came out.
And then they decided they wanted to have a teenage version, you know, because Archie's so popular, and they wanted to have stories with mermen, and she had all these boyfriends who were very strange, and they wanted to have a story with a little girl, so they had Wonder Tot, which were the stories of her as a baby. But then the Teen Titans started coming along, and they said, you know, Wonder Girl, who's Wonder Girl? We've done so many stories on who is Wonder Girl. And the story is that Wonder Woman found her. She was fighting a fire, and she found this little girl in the fire. Nobody knew who she was, so she took her back to the Amazon Island and raised her, which the Amazons would do. They would take in orphans and raise them. So she was raised on Paradise Island, and she wasn't as strong as the rest of them, so they used Paula's Purple Ray superpowers.
The
and
other
then she could
for,
do the bullets and bracelets
now,
and the lasso and everything else.
The other name for Paradise Island, unless it's a different island, is Themyscira.
Yeah, that was named later.
Yeah, now, is it true, by the way, that no men were ever allowed onto Paradise Island?
Right.
At certain times, depending on who's writing it.
Yeah.
That's, if they set foot on the island, it would fall apart.
When I was doing Nuff Said regularly and I did a Wonder Woman show, trying to sort of juggle all the different versions of Wonder Woman
and Wonder Girl
was tremendous. But they even have Impossible Adventures of Wonder Woman in the early 60s where they would have Wonder Woman, Wonder Girl, and Wonder Tot together.
Oh,
even
God.
Though they were the same person,
they
were together in the same story as if they were three people, even though they had already been established.
Machine. I don't know if you had a time machine, you could go future, and you can go in the past and get each
And they
one.
May have done that. I've never actually read any of those
They're
impossible
very goofy.
Stories.
They're very goofy.
But yeah, I've told that I don't really want to.
I don't either.
and Bob Kaniger was writing them, and he really didn't
silly.
Have a lot of respect for the but fans.
They,
and
but then, didn't they bring Wonder Woman back in the 90s for the TV show as well?
Wonder Woman has never been canceled. Wonder Woman is worth more in merchandising than she is in sales, and kind of always has been. But in the 40s, Wonder Woman sold very well.
Oh, yeah.
But there have been times when even merchandising from Wonder Woman was really cheap. where you could license a Wonder Woman project for $450.
At an ad agency in Pennsylvania.
I don't know what it is
and
now.
And we did a bunch of stuff with Scott Paper, Scott Towels, and we had the dynamic duo, Scott Paper Towels and Toilet Paper in your bathroom, you know. So they went to D.C. and they wanted to do, you know, these different characters, and Wonder Woman was really cheap, and the rest of them were like three times her price, any of the other characters you wanted to use.
By the way.
And they did the Incredible Hulk, the incredible bulk of these paper towels, you know, and they actually got... They went to Marvel and DC and licensed the characters so they could use them for these ads in like hospitality magazines and hospital magazines where they would say, buy Scott towels, you know,
by
Scott
the way,
paper
you,
towels.
By the way, you were talking, Ken, about the attitude toward Indians or Native Americans, First Nations people, as we call them in Canada, in the 50s and early 60s. The other group that really got, pardon my Gaelic, tarred and feathered were Mexicans. If you ever saw Westerns, and I'm sure you did, whether it's the Lone Ranger, whether it was, you know, a Sugarfoot or Cheyenne or Colt 45, any of the classic series. If you ever saw a Mexican, he was either a bandit or he was a lazy, shiftless peon.
Yeah.
But you never saw him as a hero. I mean, you never saw him in any positive roles.
That's true.
They were the cattle rustlers. They were coming across and they were violating Tejano women and all kinds of stuff. You know, it was terrible. And the other group that very seldom got shown in one or any pose was African Americans. Now, occasionally you would see in maybe the Big Valley or Bonanza, you'd see an ex-slave. Because remember, some of these series took place during the Civil War, or even in the case of Bonanza, before the Civil War. And I remember in one episode of Bonanza, the Cartwrights actually had to save a runaway slave because he was being chased by the fugitive slave patrollers. And
When were the Buffalo Soldiers? Was that?
Oh, the Buffalo Soldiers.
Was that during the Revolutionary War?
No.
Mostly after the Civil War.
After the Civil War. It's funny you mention that, and I'll tell you why. There is a movie that if any of you have ever seen it, it's really worth it. It stars Woody Strode, the African-American actor who actually shows up in Spartacus as an African slave. But there was a movie called Sergeant Rutledge, made in 1960, about a Buffalo soldier of the 9th Cavalry, because the Buffalo soldiers were from 9th and 10th Cavalry only. They actually...
A segregated army.
Yeah, it was, but they had white officers. But here's the thing about the Buffalo soldiers. They fought from the Canadian border all the way down to the Rio Grande, 25 years. Very few history books had ever been written about them. And the only two movies, John Preble did a book called The Buffalo Soldiers. Very few... The two movies, or two things... There was a made-for-television movie called The Buffalo Soldiers, I believe, with Danny DeVito, and this movie Sergeant Rutledge in 1960. And what do you think is the central plot of Sergeant Rutledge? He's accused of violating and murdering a white woman.
Right.
But the history of The Buffalo Soldiers is an amazing story.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, we've got another call. So
okay.
Well, thanks for calling.
Ken.
Okay, thanks for calling. 212-209-2900. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Hi.
Again.
Hey, Tim.
Just wanted to see, you know, I was just channel surfing about a while ago. I couldn't sleep. And I just said, hey, look at this. Look who's on.
Wow.
So you are the Tim that sold comics on the street, right?
Oh, yes.
You still doing that?
No, but I'm going to jump back into it because I literally fell on my face. I lost everything.
Ooh.
I'm currently in the hospital right now. I had my diabetes went completely out of control. Lost a couple of toes, but I'm going to get back on my feet soon and jump into the business.
Good, because I always thought that was important, how you brought comics to the street, because people are always going, they still make those? They just don't know that where comics have gone, because they're all in these specialty shops now. People don't see comics as like they used to.
And I always thought, you know, to me it was always about... You know, not just the fact of buying and selling, it's always about telling the story also. And, you know, that was probably the most fun about dealing with the comic books on the street, was the interaction between the customers. And half the time it led to arguments, you know.
Well, Tim, do you know whether they made a graphic novel compilation of Batlash, the Nick Hardy ones?
No, but I'm going to find out tonight. I will check it out. I've heard something about it, but I don't think so. But the problem is, so many these trade paperbacks start popping out before you know it, you know. And you say, "Oh, it came out," and then you said, "No, I never heard anything about it." But you know, it's a little in like quietly they do it. But you know, you figure they, something as significant as that, it should be, you know, give it a little bit more a little more pomp it deserves.
And there's only 7 issues of the Nick Hardy Batlash, so that's, you know, 140 some pages. So it's not going to be, you know, a really thick, expensive volume.
Yeah.
No, but I would think also is something like Batlash should, you know, to me should be on the screen, just like I would thought about the, you know, Jonah Hex. But see, the problem I was, like I said, I argued with on, you know, when I was writing the show. The problem is, you got the technology to do anything in a comic movie, but now they can't get the stories right to save their life.
Yeah, they did a Jonah Hex movie, and from what I heard, you didn't want to see it. It was dumb.
No,
it was really dumb.
It's just like, to me, I think the people who put it together are not fans of.
No, they weren't comics fans. They were saying, "Oh, comic books make." Movies make money, so let's do one. I think that's what that was, you know.
Yeah,
I don't ask for them to follow the comics slavishly, because you can do things in comics you can't do in movies, and you can do things in movies you can't do in comics. Just treat us with respect. That's all I ask
treat
of them.
Treat the material with respect.
Just
there's
treat
stories
us with respect.
You can do.
Yeah.
You know, I would just say, you know, follow the concept and appeal to the fans. You know? I mean, you look
that's so hard.
Got a better chance of changing colors sometimes.
Ooh, yeah, yeah, I hear
I
you.
Mean, like I said, I look at the movies, I mean, fine. You're making your money hand over fist, but, you know, you're going to tell me a little tweak here and a little twist here. I mean, when I try to tell people, like, for example, the Avengers, Nick Fury is white, you know.
So?
And, you know, and I'm saying is...
So is Felix Leiter, and except he shows up all different ways in James Bond, because in the book, you don't know what he looks like. You know, he's a character.
Like I said, you know...
He could be anybody.
But who's following this notion would say, wait a minute, that's not who he is. He don't look like Samuel L. Jackson. You know?
Yeah, but he was so cool.
You know, yeah, but how many brothers you know in Nicholas J. Fury? You know, I mean, but then again, if you go into the history of it, then you've got to know, this man led the Howard Commandos.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh, and so he's from really long ago.
No, but like I said, you know the character. I mean, the first thing you should do is appeal to the fans. The fans will bring, they'll come in there religiously, and if it's worth for them to see it, they will bring everyone else in there. No, you got to check this out. This movie's fantastic.
I remember going to see the Superman movies, and the first ones weren't too bad, but then there was like the fourth one, and I went to see it with a friend of mine in Philly, and we were sinking down in our seats hoping nobody we knew was there, because we were like, we're embarrassed to be comic fans seeing that crap up on the screen. It was like, this is not what we expect, you know, from our characters. It was just, and it was chopped up. There was a lot more to that movie. It was edited out. There was a political message to it, and they edited it out.
The one that Chris Reeves directed,
Yeah, the Chris Reeves movie. And
yeah, they
just,
took 25 minutes out of
it. Beautiful,
movie.
But it was so many dumb bits in it.
Yes, and I mean, a problem like that. You know, you've got someone significant as a Superman. You've got such a history, and to me, it seemed like they're going to try to sweetie 50, 60, 70 years into one movie.
Well, Tim, stay on the line. Let me bring in another caller.
You got it.
All right.
And so we'll have a four-way conversation.
Woohoo!
212-209-2900. You're on the air, too.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. This is Mike Catron.
Oh, cool.
Mike Catron.
Hi, Mike.
Calling from the other side of the country.
That's right. I'm in Seattle.
Wow.
I'm online. But I wanted to talk to you about Nick Hardy.
Oh, great, yes.
He's one of my favorite artists, too. And one thing that I thought you might, if you can remember some of the horror covers he did for DC for
Ghosts and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic stuff.
Yeah, he did some amazing horror comics.
Great atmosphere.
Something they don't do enough of, you ask me.
The Witching Hour. He did,
that's
Witching Hour covers and Dark Mansions of Forbidden
Love. He did a lot of the covers when Dick Giordano was editing
Unexpected.
The horror comics.
Yeah. I'm looking through the book here and just reading off titles.
What is the name of that book you're going through right now, ma'am?
It's called The Art of Nick Hardy, and it's got it was put out by Vanguard Press. The Art of Nick Hardy. I got a paperback version here, but it was from paperback and hardback from Lebanon, New Jersey.
So, Vanguard Mike, do you have any Nick Hardy stories to tell us?
I'm afraid I don't. I didn't know him very well. I saw him at conventions now and again, but no special stories for you. But I just wanted to bring up those. You don't normally think of, at least I don't think of Nick Hardy with the horror stuff. Even the monsters he drew were kind of pretty.
What a cute Cthulhu. That's pretty. He did have a nice line. A nice line in Lines.
Yeah. He was doing a lot of covers at that time, and they gave him some of that. They called him mystery, but they were supposed to be horror covers.
Right, horror comics.
Yeah, because they went somehow, horror was like not politically correct or something. Oh, I should mention, there's going to be a memorial to Nick Carty at Heroes Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina this coming June.
Awesome. And I would love
And
he did see Don't Believe in Ghosts, House of Sinister, Secrets of Sinister House, The Witching Hour.
Yeah, DC House was trying gothic romance horror for a little while, and they had Nick do the covers for those.
Forbidden Tales of Dark Mansion.
Because they didn't want it to look like typical comic book covers.
The Witching Hour.
You know, it occurs to me he's the kind of guy who, had he wanted to, could have had a career doing romance paperback covers and things like
he
that.
He did a bunch of those for a while, because I've seen one copy. But I think he did, because my friend Margie had a bunch of those. She had some of his covers.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never actually, I've looked for them and I've never actually found them because his name's not on it. It's just, I can tell his art, you know, yeah. I can see it and I just know. But it was definitely Nick Carty.
The question here is his work influenced to any movies that's been done recently or in the past?
Mike, you want to take that one?
I don't think I heard it.
Tim was asking about the Nick's influence on movies, on the movies that have been coming out lately.
Hmm.
I understand he did some movie posters.
Yeah, he did posters back in the 70s and 80s.
Right, but nothing recent that I'm aware of.
I'm thinking more of the inspiration of the content of the movies.
I really can't think of it.
I don't know the movies well enough to be able to answer that.
From what I was listening earlier before I got on, this man was really an influential person with his art style and storylines. But I said, you think you would, this boy would be on the his work would be least influenced to put stuff on the screen back then or now.
I mean, he was the main design man of DC Comics in the 70s, having done all those covers. So they took advantage of his sense of design. So that's going to influence any movie maker. And, for a long time, Nick was sort of an artist's artist. When fans would say their top favorite artists, Nick may not have made the list. But when artists said their top 10 artists, Nick was always on the list. And it's interesting that people like Alex Toth and Kurt Swan are appreciated more by other artists than they are by the fans who actually buy the work.
Definitely, I understand that.
A lot of those covers that he did for DC, probably the majority of the covers he did for DC, were based on layouts or designs by Carmine Infantino.
Yeah, that's true. Carmine would do the layouts, although Nick would sometimes change them a lot and sometimes change them a little.
And I think that he may have gotten away with more of that than some of the other artists. I think Carmine appreciated what Nick brought to the piece.
Well, and in fact, Nick, in that book, Nick tells the story of asking for a raise and Irwin Donenfeld firing him. And Carmine say, no, you can't leave. We can't lose Nick Carty. And he got the raise, but he was Nick was so demoralized in Donenfeld's treatment of him that he prepared his portfolio to start doing advertising work and movie posters. So though he did not get fired at that moment, we ended up losing him anyway as a result of that.
Mark Wade says, Nick Carty was almost certainly the first comics artist whose work made me sit up and take notice. In an era of DC Comics marked by lifeless, dowdy artwork, Carty's illustrations were singularly energetic, bringing characters to life with a sprightly panache and jaunty flair no one else could match then or now.
Well, especially those Aquaman covers. The covers you did for Aquaman in the 60s were just truly amazing.
Oh, they were dynamic.
And he
amazing,
took all of the influence of the fine art he had studied, as well as Will Eisner and Bernd Hogarth, and combined it all to some amazing designs and stood up and take notice. I don't know if there's a better way of putting it than that. it really commanded your attention.
Indeed.
And I mean, I would hope that the internet has been buzzing about Nick Carty nonstop since the 3rd. Because
oh yeah, there's a lot of stuff on the Comic Book Scholars about Nick.
Yeah, the Comic Scholars, but even the Comic Scholars didn't talk about him a lot. They talked about him for a little while.
Mm.
And there's a nice obituary to him that I linked to from the Nuffstead webpage, comicbookradioshow.com. If you go to the guest page, I link to that obituary. It's a very nice one with quite a few cover examples on there.
Mm-hmm. That's good to see those things, because once people see his stuff, they go, oh, yeah, I remember him. But they don't. Not many people know the name.
That's the
it's
other
when they
problem.
See it, they go, "Oh, yeah."
Yeah, it's definitely influenced by the style.
Yeah, there were no credits.
Yeah.
In those days, so you could look at the art and you could recognize, I like this guy. I don't like this guy as much, but you don't know who it is that you like and who it is that you didn't like.
Boy, Bob Kane sure draws different every time I see him. It's really crazy.
And so
sometimes he'd just do a little NC. He would put his signature, a little NC on yeah. Rio and stuff. But a lot of Rios, Senorita Rios, were not signed. And he did Fiction House and Wings Comics with Ladies with Planes, you know. Because back then, they didn't have Playboy and Penthouse. These were the pinup magazines that people took into the army with them. And they had them hidden under their mattress and stuffed in the back of the drawer because they didn't have adult magazines. So they were pinups, and they had what they called good girl art. With some amazing artwork by people back then, Jean Bilbrew and all different. Oh, Bob, there was a guy, Bob Barker. Oh, I can't think of his name right now. I'm losing it. But that was their pinup stuff. That was their adult magazines. Was comic books. Like
what's interesting also is the Fiction House as a company employed more women than probably any other comic book company. In history until some of the independents.
Writers and artists, yeah.
You know, and in the last 20 years, there's a lot of independent companies that are run by women. But when they were only on the newsstands, Fiction House was the one that employed the most women and did the most pin-up-y type comics as well. Somehow in these stories, the female characters kept falling in water.
Yeah, well, the guy I used to draw for, he said he wondered if her name was Rio because she was always wet. Because the clinging clothes, you know, and you could see every line with the wet clothes, the way they would cling.
Up to a point, because it still was the 40s and 50s.
Yes, they hadn't invented nipples yet. So.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was shy. They were very shy.
It's a very different era.
But you could see the bumps on her garters, on her girdle, you know, that was delineated carefully and delicately. There's some beautiful art, and that was their pinups at the time. They didn't have Playboy yet, you know. So this was the stuff that the guys were reading. So there's a lot of pretty girls, and Nick Carty was great at that. He was great at pretty girls.
This was during what, the 40s and 50s?
Yep. 40s, 47.
Yeah, well, Playboy started in, 54 or around there?
52, I believe.
Okay, so this is 1940, 1947.
So we're talking about, you know, Nick Carty started in comics in 1939.
Incredible.
So, you know, things were very different, and the comics were so huge that you would have comics for kids, and you have comics for older kids and young adults, and after World War II especially, because the soldiers were reading comics in Europe and in the Pacific Theater, and were still wanted to read them when they got home, but now they're older, so the publishers made comics for them. But then you had people going, wait a minute, these comic books are for older people. Comic books are only supposed to be for children. And now you have a conflict.
Nah.
And that ends the Senate hearings and a comic book code and everything else.
Keith Oliver. Yeah. And Dr. Wortham got into it.
But
there's still people who go into comic book shops and are horrified by, you know, oh my God, they like, what was the one about Archie? The guy was looking for Archie comics and he found Cherry. Remember that one?
Oh,
Cherry
Pop-Tart. Tim and Mike are laughing because they know who Cherry is. But yeah, we're in a comic book store in the East Village, and this guy comes in. You know, he's wearing a suit, and he goes, "Oh, I haven't read comics in years." And he's wandering through the store, and one of the clerks is sort of following him around, and then he's like sees Cherry. Now Cherry, first two issues are called Cherry Pop-Tart. What was an R-rated comic?
An
X-rated comic.
It was very rude.
It was an X-rated comic.
She had jobs and everything.
She had sex. You know, everybody was naked.
And her mom
male
had sex.
And women alike. And
all foxy.
But the covers were done. Artists. It was like Dan. You know, if Dan DiCarlo had done an X-rated comic, it might look like Cherry. And so this young man goes in there and he goes, I remember these. And he grabs a cherry and the clerk is like, that's not what you think it is.
That's not an Archie comic.
So the person starts leafing through it and says, no, it's not. And that's what he bought.
He said, that's nice.
But in the 50s, that would have been condemned.
That was rude. Yeah, it was too rude for the 50s.
And in Texas, it would have been condemned too. Like Keith's Comics in Dallas, that the owner and manager got arrested for selling an adult comic book to an adult. And it went to court.
That was
and
recent.
They lost.
That was in the 2000s, right?
Yeah, that was around 2002.
Ridiculous.
So that kind of stuff is still existing. So the part about, you know, the only pinups they had were comics. And I should mention another influence of Nick Carty's was magazine illustration. The golden age of magazine illustration in the early 20th century was a huge influence.
There were a lot more magazines and there was a lot of art. Yeah, wasn't much photography.
And he won a contest when he was a teenager.
Wow.
He was from the Lower East Side of Manhattan when it was an Italian neighborhood. The Lower East Side has been all different kinds of ethnics as the immigrant population changes. And when it was an Italian neighborhood, that's where Nick lived. His parents spoke Italian, didn't speak English much at all.
Right.
And he won contests when he was like 13 and 14 and 15 years old.
Yeah, he was drawing his artwork. Early. Yeah. He did a mural in the school where he was, and I don't know if it's still up there.
I don't know if the mural is there, but
that was an award winner.
Somebody saved the picture of it because it's in the art of Nick Carty.
Yeah.
And, you know, look at that and going, this person was 14? Well, no wonder he became Nick Carty when he grew up.
My God.
Amazing, amazing artwork.
But yeah, if you can find it, check out, there's a book on his stuff during the war that he did. And some of those look like photographs. They're amazing, beautiful paintings that he did during the war in the 40s and 45.
Do you know what the name of that is?
I don't know the name of it. It's like it's about Nick Carty. It was pretty recent because Donna had it. Donna Martinez had a copy of it. I was reading it at her house. And it's about war, so it's hard for me to look at. But it's Nick Carty!
Conundrum.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's amazing. Here he is, you know, driving a tank on his way from France to Germany, and he's carrying paper and he's carrying ink
and a sketchbook all the time.
And paint and everything else. I mean, that's why he became Nick Carty, because he was always drawing.
Drawing and painting.
He was compelled to draw.
He did the logo for their battalion of a panther. He did a drawing for that they put on they stenciled it on the tank.
They still use it to this day.
They still use it, yeah.
The Black Panther Battalion. Still uses Nick Carty's art from 1943.
Because it's so good.
And it's now a tradition.
Right.
Basically, exciting. As a comic book fan, all I can say is, boy, we sure were lucky that Nick Carty was drawing for comics, because he could have been doing paintings, he could have been doing advertising, could have been doing anything.
Yeah.
And he did comics, and we got to enjoy his work telling a story, which is a whole other skill besides just beautiful drawings, is to tell a story with them.
Yeah, to be able to give a story image, you know, with one picture.
With a poster, it's one angle, it's one picture,
bang.
Whatever it is. With comics, of course, you have to change the angles, you have to change the distance, whether it's a close-up or a distance shot, an establishing shot. You have to do the artwork from above, you have to do it from below, and you have to tell a story all at the same time. You have to draw people, you have to draw animals, you have to draw buildings, you have to draw energy, you have to draw monsters, and
beautiful girls.
Tell a story at the same time. And so comic book art is
handsome guy
is very difficult. And the people who can do it well are people who could do artwork anywhere. But luckily we get them.
I think that's true, Ken, because, you know, Carty, you know, I think people from a certain period of time think of his, the work that he did on his superheroes, like the Teen Titans and the others.
Yes.
But, you know, you already mentioned Batlash, the Westerns, and Tomahawk. He did Westerns, he did romance. He did some gangbuster stuff, which is crime comics in the 50s he did for DC. So, you know, he was able to work in all these different genres, I guess whatever was popular at the time. Which made him a very versatile artist, which I think is extraordinary.
And it's funny because when people would say, yeah, what's your favorite? Yeah, he kind of hemmed and hawed.
watercolors.
Yeah, it's
he really loved doing watercolors.
Yeah, so some artists made a point of talking about what they like to draw and would go out of the way to say, I didn't like superheroes if they were known for it. Mm-hmm. And Nick, I don't
Kurt
know if he was afraid of insulting somebody or whatever.
He liked doing the Legion,
whatever.
But there were so darn many of them. It drove him crazy doing the Legion.
So Nick Carty did so much great stuff, and he was so nice about it and so nice to the fans, which the old-timers tend to be. They worked in anonymity. They were totally invisible. And then they go to a convention, and there are people calling them gods to their faces. And before that, they were like, okay, thanks for handing it on time. Here's your next assignment.
Yeah, and knock it out.
And their signatures would be whited out or blackened because
somebody else's name put
on it. They were afraid of the star system.
Afraid they'd ask for too much money.
They found out, the star system was a good thing because it added to sales, but they were afraid it would detract. Mm-hmm. In some way, or the stars would ask for more money.
Oh, this is the companies doing this?
The companies, would have if the artist dared to sign their work, the companies would have somebody erase it in some way, either cover it with white, cover it with black, they would cover it with something.
Yep.
So artists got very creative in finding ways to sign their artwork.
Right.
So you'd be going past a building, and the building would have somebody's name on it. Oh, that's the artist's name. And they would do this all the time.
That tradition was sort of carried on in the Batman animated when it first came out. They'd have the Eisner Building. Yeah.
Every street corner in Gotham City in the Batman animated was the name of a writer or artist.
Yeah,
or editor.
They kept throwing them in there, which is great fun. So we're running out of time.
We are running out of time, and Lister is here, ready to do his show. And
I only have one thing to say. Cardi, Cardi, Cardi!
Well, thank you, Mercy Van Vlack, for joining us in this hour and a half.
And thank you, Jim Freund, for this opportunity.
Yes, thank you very much, Jim.
I'm sorry you're sick. I hope you feel better.
And thanks, Mike Hatron, and thanks, Tim Ungen, for calling in.
Thank you guys for just being back on the air.
And Robert and the other callers who've called in, appreciate your contribution to the show. And so I feel like we should go out with Senorita Rio again.
Mercy
likes the character so much.
She dances on the set.
Her career. Because she went in to do cartoons for Lake Show, and the editor said, "You do comics?
Yeah.
Do a comic strip for me." And then Mercy starts talking about Senorita Rio, and suddenly Miranda was born.
Yep.
And that's why Miranda is Spanish, because Senorita Rio was Spanish.
Yep.
And we would call our friends and ask for what's an appropriate phrase to use in this situation.
Cielo.
Some of them were not very nice words,
but funny.
But they were appropriate for an X-rated comic. So, Hour of the Wolf is now ending, and Lister is coming in. It's WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org.
talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Sync a list alive right here. 8 minutes, 8 minutes after flag burning time, where we burn Imperial's flag to ashes. To ashes, baby. Ashes. Uh-huh. Tonight's Sync called List Alive. The show had to be called Burn. Burn, baby, burn. Clappers until 5 o'clock. Woo! Here we go.